You're listening to Clinical Conversations, formerly known as Admitting Diagnosis, the Journal Watch podcast for March 20th. I'm Joe Elia, and you can start a conversation or just suggest one with a call to 1-617-440-4374. We'll take a quick look at the week's news and then launch into an interview. Once again, we had trouble bagging an interviewee. This week's invited guest felt a prior commitment to another outlet, which shall remain unnamed. Hello, Chicago. Don't worry. We had a good conversation last summer with Mary Tinetti about falls in the elderly and how to prevent them. We'll bring you that one instead. First, the recent clinical news. It was a week of new data on old controversies. Principal among them were two studies on prostate cancer screening published in the New England Journal of Medicine. One study, conducted in the U.S., found that screening does not lower mortality from the disease. However, a European study found that death rates were lower among those who were offered screening. Alan Brett, for one, has had enough. In Journal Watch General Medicine, he writes the following. Healthcare policymakers also need to ask boldly whether the PSA screening juggernaut, with all the time, energy, and resources consumed by screening and its sequelae, is appropriate in an era of unsustainable growth in healthcare spending. Next, another controversy that stalks clinicians is the PCI versus CABG question. Lancet released online an analysis of 10 randomized trials. The data were examined at the patient level in a collaborative effort. This is no mere meta-analysis. What did they find? Well, bear in mind that the PCI treatments were balloon angioplasties and bare metal stents, and that most studies were done when medical treatments were less effective than they are now. All that aside, the analysis found that in multivessel disease, CABG seems to offer a survival advantage among diabetics and among those 65 and older. Finally, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force has updated its recommendations on the use of aspirin to prevent cardiovascular disease. The new recommendations emphasize that aspirin has different effects in men and women, and that it should be used in men after age 45 to prevent MIs, and in women after age 55 to prevent ischemic strokes. Writing in the Annals of Internal Medicine, an editorialist reminds us that, quoting, aspirin continues to be underused, and the routine incorporation of the USPSTF's recommendations will prevent many thousands of cardiovascular events every year. Now on to the interview. The New England Journal of Medicine published a research paper on falls in people over 70. Over a five-year span, the researchers studied two geographic regions in the state of Connecticut, an intervention region and a usual care region. During the first 3 years, they tried to alert as many primary care clinicians as they could in the intervention region about ways to prevent falls. Clinicians in the usual care region were left alone. The last 2 years of the study were spent observing rates of fall-related injuries and usage rates of fall-related medical services among elders in both regions. The results favored the intervention region, relative to usual care, by about 10%. We've asked Dr. Mary Tinetti, the first author on the NEJM paper, to talk with us about the implications of all this. Dr. Tinetti is the Gladys Phillips Crowfoot Professor of Medicine and Epidemiology and Public Health at Yale, and she directs Yale's program on aging. Welcome, Dr. Tinetti, and thank you for agreeing to speak with us today.
Thank you.
You're known among clinicians as the inventor of the get-up-and-go test. How did you get interested in this research area?
Well, thank you. Actually, I did not invent the get-up-and-go test. That's a British test, but I have one that's quite similar to that, what we call the mobility test.
Uh-huh.
The name isn't as interesting, so the get-up-and-go is what people remember.
I see.
I first got interested in the problem of mobility and falling in older people when I was a fellow training in geriatric medicine at University of Rochester with Dr. Franklin Williams, and observed how many people, as they got older, had a problem with falling. And it seemed to me and to Dr. Williams that it sort of was a neglected area. We assumed that it was just something that happened as people got older. But as I got to understand medicine more and the health of older people more, it became quite clear that it was not something that was inevitable, but something that occurred to a group of older people when they started accumulating health problems that affected their balance and their walking and their ability to get around safely. So my interest in the problem dates back over two decades now.
Were you surprised at the difference in usage rates between the two areas of the state?
We were surprised, and pleasantly surprised, that we knew that under very controlled situations that we're able to prevent a fair number of falls by older people. But in the studies that had happened previously, there were investigators who identified the older people who would be part of the studies and made absolutely sure that people got the intervention. So in that environment, we knew it worked. What we didn't know was whether clinicians taking care of older people, physicians in their offices, nurses in home care, physical therapists and occupational therapists would be willing and able to look at health conditions that put people at risk for falling and intervene on them, and whether those interventions would result in fewer serious fall injuries and fall utilizations in older people. So we were pleasantly surprised at how effective it was.
Given the amount of things that have to take place in a clinical encounter, the kind of recommendations that you make for trying to inform patients about avoiding falls, does it seem to you that it's worth that effort to do?
Well, that's an excellent question, and we wonder that as well. These are patients who already have several health problems. Their physicians already have to check multiple different things in these people, and it's just on the one hand you look at it and say, gosh, this is just one more thing we need to do. One of the things that we did that was we were very, very careful on identifying what was essential for physicians to do and older patients to do, and really tried to make it as time limited as possible. Number one is the recommendations are, and I think this is really important to bear in mind, reducing medications if at all possible, checking blood pressure when people are standing to see if it drops too much, to see if people are safe walking. It's important to bear in mind that those are health conditions that even apart from their risk for falling and having a hip fracture or head injury really do impair their quality of life and their health. So what we were asking people to do were things that have benefit beyond fall prevention itself. So that's what really made us quite comfortable. And we talked to the physicians and the nurses and physical therapists and asked them, you know, what are the things that we can help you with that will make this possible for you to incorporate this into your practice, which we already know is busy and overwhelming, and what are the things that would keep you from doing it? And we try to, you know, we really try to listen to what they were telling us and, again, make it as simple and doable as possible.
And what did they say? What did they tell you would be most helpful? Is it patient education materials or is it is it a checklist?
Well, I think there's the question. The response we got the most often, and, again, we were a little surprised at this as well. They said the most important thing you can do is to get our patients to ask us to do this. What they told us is that even though we have a lot of demands on our time, a lot of people are telling us to do things, the people we listen to the most is the patient right in front of us.
Yes.
So that was sort of interesting because it sort of made us realize that we also needed to talk to older people and their families as well. That being said, some of the other things that they suggested was help us identify how we can get reimbursement under Medicare, because essentially all of the patients we're talking about are covered by Medicare. So we're able to give them clues on and tips on how to get reimbursed for their time under Medicare. They did also ask us for, you know, I don't always know the physical therapist in my area. How can I find the physical therapist to refer my patient to? So we did sort of connect them to to other healthcare providers in their area. We showed them how to get reimbursed by Medicare, and we did have a very simple checklist. A very simple checklist that just said, this is the health condition that puts person at risk for falling. This is the thing that you can do. So we tried again, and then that was something that they said was very helpful.
So in order to get the patients to talk with their clinicians about this, I saw in the paper that you actually had advertisements in buses and other places, public awareness things about falls. Is that right?
Correct. That's correct. We had buses that drove through throughout the Hartford area. We put posters throughout areas where older people live, often where they go to church, where they get their health care. We had brochures. We went to libraries. We went to senior centers. Any place where we felt older people either lived, congregated, or got their health care, we put information. We had a ad campaign on the TV and radio as well.
So it's no wonder that you spent 3 years just educating people.
Exactly right.
I noticed that that you visited all of the region's home care agencies and most 85 to 90% of the senior centers and the rehab
Correct.
Offices, but only about half the primary care clinicians' offices. Were there just too many of them and too few of you to?
No, actually, we contacted every primary care office that served our region. With home care, it's and rehabilitation, there's sort of a set place that people go, and there's several nurses in the home care agency and several physical therapists or occupational therapists in the rehabilitation facility. The problem with primary care is still primarily there's two or three doctors in the inner office, and very often still a lot of primary care physicians practice alone. So although we think the media sort of tells us about these big conglomerates of large practices, most physicians still practice alone. And it's just hard for them. They just don't have the time in their day. A lot of them didn't even have, they don't have office staff, some of them, but they're just really too busy. So we were actually, again, pleasantly surprised, not that there were primary care physicians who wouldn't see us, but that these very, very busy primary care physicians were willing to see us.
So you probably had more luck getting in to see them than the drug detailers do.
Well, we hope so, and we didn't bring donuts. Or pens.
Or pizza.
Or pizza, right. We did think of it, though. I will have to admit it. We did discuss it.
You've been doing this research throughout your career. I read on Yale's website that you've mentored dozens of med students and fellows and junior faculty. What advice do you give them before you send them off into the world?
That you have to love what you do, that no matter what direction you go in, there's going to be days that you love and days that you hate. There's going to be bureaucracy and paperwork that's going to drive you crazy, but stay focused on what's important, and it's always what's doing best for the patients that you're working with. And my experience is that most medical students and residents and fellows get into medicine because they want to help people.
What's next? Are you doing further follow-up on this group, or can't you say?
No, I can say. You know, if you read most medical articles, the last sentence always is more research is needed. Our feeling is this is an area where the research is done, and it's just time to do it. And so most of our efforts right now in the area of fall prevention is further dissemination. A couple of my colleagues, Dr. Dorothy Baker and Margaret Gottschalk, have funding from the state of Connecticut to go to the rest of the state that wasn't part of the intervention area and disseminate the fall prevention evidence in the other areas of the state. We're also working nationally with different groups to try to disseminate the information as much as possible, to do whatever we can to just to get it so that it's an absolutely normal and regular part of healthcare. Just like we think about blood pressure, we think about stroke prevention, smoking cessation. Our goal is to have looking for fall risk factors and intervening to prevent falls and maintain walking safety to be part of normal and usual healthcare.
Is there a resource that you could give our listeners, a website, for instance, that they could go to get the checklist or to be reminded of what the interventions are that they could be using?
Yes, our website is fallprevention, all one word, .org. And they can order the materials that we used in the study through there. The National Institute on Aging also has a website that has a lot of good patient education material,
mm-hmm.
and I think that's called Senior Health.
They can Google it.
Yes,
is it SeniorHealth dot?
Pretty sure it's SeniorHealth.gov.
Well, as we said, they can Google it.
Right.
Everything is Googleable now.
Everything is Googleable.
All right, Dr. Tinetti, thank you so much for your time with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Finally this week, let us know what you think by calling 1-617-440-4374 and leaving a brief message. I'd especially like to know your ideas for future podcasts. Now, don't be shy. Clinical Conversations executive producer is Ador Yano, and I'm Joe Elia, a mere conversationalist. We'll see you next week. Meanwhile, enjoy the change of seasons. Thanks for listening.